All the Rage with John Bowd on www.tracksfm.org.
Hello again, listeners, to All the Rage. Welcome wherever you are in the world. Solidarity with all of you out there in these very troubling times. I'm very glad to say that yet again this week we have a guest, and I'm going to pass over to introduce himself. Please introduce yourself, sir.
Hi, yeah, I'm Shabir Larker. I'm an officer with the Stop the War Coalition, and I'm an activist with the People's Assembly Against Austerity, and I've been involved in various campaigns and movements for the last probably about 10 years. Helped to organize some of the demonstrations against Donald Trump when he came to London in the last few years. And I've recently been active in the Black Lives Matter movement and at the protests.
Excellent. So I'm sure our listeners, wherever they are, know what's going on. But right now, I think it's fair to say globally, there is a lot of activity going on with the Black Lives Matter movement. This isn't a new movement. It's been around for a few years, but the particular events that sparked off the latest wave of activism have been related to the police murder of a gentleman named George Floyd. These protests have spread from America, all over America, to Europe, some parts of Latin America, etc., various other places. One that's very close to home for those of us recording this show is Harrow, which is where many of us reside, or in my case, semi-reside. So I met you at a Harrow Black Lives Matter event a couple of weeks back, a couple of Saturdays ago. Can you just tell us a little bit about your specific involvement with this group? I don't know if this is a group that you join per se, but how did you first get involved with Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, so I mean, there is a Black Lives Matter organization, more in the US than here, but there is one here as well. But essentially, most of the protests that we've seen have been kind of spontaneously organized by individuals, by various, you know, existing networks for other campaigns, which have, you know, come together to call these protests. So there hasn't been a kind of centralized structure as such. And I'm not involved with the Black Lives Matter organization as such. The Harrow protest was actually organized by Pamela Fitzpatrick, who's a local councillor.
Very well known on this show. She was our first guest.
Yeah, she's absolutely great. And she got it together with a few other people and inside and outside the Labour Party, and they kind of organized the protest. And that's how I found out about it and came down to it.
You gave a very powerful speech, I thought, and very well done. And where did, this sounds like an odd thing to say, like, where did it come from? But maybe I'm not being articulate enough, but did you, were you asked to speak, or did you put yourself forward? Did you feel compelled that there was these very, very important things that I have to say?
Yeah, I mean, Pamela did ask me to speak because I am an activist with the Stop the War Coalition and the People's Assembly. So I have been involved in a lot of demonstrations. I've spoken at some, I've spoken at public meetings. I absolutely did feel compelled to speak. I mean, it was a very powerful protest. I think possibly the biggest protest in Harrow since at least the kind of anti-war movement in 2003. It was about 100 people, all socially distanced. It was a moment of really great solidarity. And the issue itself is, of course, very burning. I mean, a lot of people will have watched the video of what happened to George Floyd. But more than that, we all know that it goes a lot deeper than just one instance of police brutality. It is a very systemic issue which affects Black and brown people, not only in the US, but here as well, is a daily reality. I felt very moved to you know, make some arguments and be able to speak to a crowd in that kind of solidarity and hopefully, you know, give people some motivation to carry on.
Most certainly. Were you, see, I find, and correct me if you disagree here, but Harrow's not by any means one of the worst, but it's a fairly middle of the road type area, perhaps with a bit of a small C conservatism. So, although it's nowhere near as bad as Hillingdon, do you think the turnout of the demo was good? Were you disappointed in any way? Did you want to see more?
I mean, like I said, there hasn't been kind of loads of on the street activity in Harrow for a long time. So I think it was a great turn. I was really impressed and empowered by it. And I think you're right that there is kind of small C conservatism in Harrow. But I do think obviously we do have a very large working class community, a very large ethnic minority community in Harrow. Sure. And there are lots of issues which directly affect people in Harrow relating to Black Lives Matter, relating to austerity and other things. I don't think there's a kind of overwhelming case that, you know, people in Harrow wouldn't be interested in something like this. And I think that that protest was a bit of a testament to that. I think I would love to see more activity in Harrow which can bring people in. I mean, one of the things I noticed in the last 3 months around the, you know, with the coronavirus pandemic is Harrow has been one of the hardest hit areas in the country in terms of kind of age standardized statistics. And I think that's largely down to the fact that there are so many ethnic minority working class people who have had to carry on working throughout this lockdown, who have, because of that kind of structural racism and, you know, class inequalities, have been more vulnerable to being impacted by the virus. And so, you know, that is there in our areas, and I think we just need to build on it.
Yeah, I mean, this is, and I actually had a few conversations with Pamela about this, about the way that, of course, you know, COVID-19 is not a disease that hits us all equally. That's not really possible in this country, any if it ever was, certainly not anymore. I very much get that sense, you know, that that this is disproportionately affecting people. We have had some interesting things I've noticed about homelessness, which is a subject we come back to on this show a lot. And we've seen a growing homeless problem in Harrow in recent years. But that seems to not be as severe as it was, because now we're actually letting people indoors, which is an interesting place to be, because it also means we're now going to, as a coronavirus lockdown, whatever you want to call it, begins to come to an end, for better or worse, we are now, the argument we're now having in the homelessness advocacy area is to keep people indoors rather than take them in.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they were able to house people during this pandemic shows that it was always possible. It is very much a political choice.
Exactly. They discovered an amazing thing during the coronavirus. It's a concept called political will.
Yeah.
Which is, when you have it, it's an amazing amount of things you can achieve. Okay, back to Black Lives Matter for a moment. Tell us a little bit about the kind of everyday stuff that you were you kind of mentioned earlier, but that people of the BAME community and Black people in particular have to put up with, you know, institutional racism or police antagonism, or even just social stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think racism is very deeply rooted in the society that we live in the kind of structures of the system, and I think it manifests in different ways. So, for example, if you're Black and ethnic minority in this country, like I said, because of the fact that you are predominantly working class and all the things that comes with, you're more likely to, for example, be vulnerable to the coronavirus. But there's also other things, and, you know, any Black and brown person can tell you about kind of overt discrimination, hate speech, being intimidated on the street, and that kind of stuff. You have a lower chance of getting a job or the kind of job you want. You are discriminated at work. In schools, you are more likely to be excluded. You're more likely to not have the same level of attainment as your white counterparts. And with the police, you know, you're more likely to be stopped and searched. In these last 3 months under the lockdown, Black and ethnic minority people were disproportionately stopped by the police, were fined by the police. So these are all the kind of daily realities of racism. But I think it also goes deeper in terms of the structures. So when we have had 10 years of austerity. It has been black and brown people who have been hit the worst, who've been most vulnerable to those cuts. And yeah, so I think it goes very much into the very nature of capitalist society and how it's developed and created these racialized issues which affect black and brown people.
As far as the social, I suspect this maybe isn't quite so much institutional, but kind of social aspects of racism. This is a slightly loaded question, and I make no apologies for it to the listeners. Have you seen an increase since the Brexit vote, do you think?
Yeah, I have personally, and I mean, also the statistics show that there was, a big spike in kind of racist hate crimes after the Brexit vote. I think, and it's not surprising to see when you consider the absolutely overt racist rhetoric that the Vote Leave campaign, the mainstream campaign, was pushing. People like Nigel Farage standing in front of that billboard about with refugees and, the kind of arguments that were being used, which scapegoated migrants and ethnic minorities. It's not surprising that there was this spike, and there definitely has been.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed it too, in a very, very grim way, except also as someone who's worked in anti-fascism for some time, I do kind of feel like certainly my white counterparts have been saying to them, well, I mean, I've seen this happening for so long, you've never really dealt with it. It's a bit of a, in the middle of a road thing is kind of a way of imagining that fascism doesn't really exist,
Yeah.
And they never deal with it.
The disclaimer I would add is that the mainstream Remain campaign, which was led by the government and some sections of the Labour Party, was equally racist. I mean, their argument was that we should stay in the European Union, but also end freedom of movement. And, those migrants are a problem, but, leaving the EU isn't the solution. So they kind of still stoked that anti-immigrant, that xenophobic argument along with the mainstream Leave campaign as well.
No, I agree. And it's a particular thing that angers me is that so many people on any spectrum, particularly on the left, seem to just be, particularly in the more mainstream sector, seem to just be incapable of not only standing up for immigrants, but saying, immigration is a good thing.
Yeah.
This just seems to be this tactic acceptance that and I find it particularly offensive too, because the idea of this, not just the general public, but the general working class public, are this mob of frothing gammon who hate, black and brown people or even Eastern Europeans. Hey, finally some white people we can have a go at, that kind of thing. And I really find that disgusting. Which isn't to say that these things haven't happened, but of course there's some element of it, but it's like it's a sort of accepted notion that, hey, Britain, is worse off for immigration and people hate them, so we need to take this stance. That's bollocks, absolute rubbish. You've got no proof of that. Not even if you did, I don't care. Try making a moral stance at some point or another.
Yeah.
Do people not get into politics for morals anymore? Or did they ever? That's another show entirely.
Exactly, yeah.
Anyway, moving on, just a little point to stop and say, I believe this makes week two in which I have a radio show and Farage doesn't, so fuck you, Nigel. Excellent. So what are, I don't know, please feel free to bat this one and we can always edit it out, but I don't know if you feel pretty comfortable answering this, but are you comfortable saying what are the main objectives of Black Lives Matter, nationally, internationally, and even locally?
Like I said before, there isn't a kind of centralized organization. There isn't a kind of, when the movement erupted initially in 2014, and in the United States, people like Angela Davis and Linda Sarsour and others were kind of at the forefront of that organization. They did produce a kind of 10-point charter for the movement. A lot of that, if not all of it, still stands. But in terms of the kind of present movement on the streets, there isn't a particular set of demands or a manifesto as such. But I think if I can speak to a little bit about what the movement is trying to do from what I can see, is that, in the United States, it's very much oriented around tackling systemic racism with the kind of immediate demands are relating to the police. So we've seen the kind of campaign to defund the police kick off in a big way across the United States. And you know, you see these eye-watering figures, like in New York, the police department has a budget of $6 billion annually. And so that there's a kind of campaign to withdraw some of that funding from the police and instead use it in the communities which are, you know, affected by racism, you know, communities of Black and brown people. And in the United States, more than here, but, you know, it also exists here, there, you know, it's a lot more segregated, the communities. So that would have a much bigger impact as well. I mean, in some places like Minneapolis itself, where George Floyd was murdered, they, you know, they're discussing abolishing the police entirely. And, you know, the conversation goes wider as well in terms of democratic representation, in terms of education, in terms of kind of legacy of the Confederacy and bringing down statues and all kinds of things. So that's happening. I think in the UK, the kind of big things that I think our movement is and should be looking towards is the fact, firstly, that we have Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, you know, an out and out racist who said the most vile things, whose government has presided over the Windrush scandal and the hostile environment and Grenfell and all these things. And so we need accountability, firstly, there and then in terms of our government, in terms of, you know, bringing them out of power, really. There's also a lot of talk about, you know, fixing the education curriculum in schools so that, you know, people, you know, young children are learning about the realities of colonialism and imperialism, which, of course, the legacies of, you know, are directly related to the racism that we have today. So there's that. And there's also kind of very immediate things in terms of justice for Beli Mujinga, for example, who was a worker in the London Underground station who was forced to work even though she had respiratory problems and who was then spat at by someone who was infected with the coronavirus and she died as a result. And nothing's been done about that. And so there's justice for her. There's, you know, the issue of the fact that BAME people are more likely to have died from coronavirus. And there's other issues of, you know, police brutality. We've seen, you know, huge numbers of Black people who've died in police custody in the last 10, 20, 30 years, and demanding justice for them and a kind of looking at how the police behave and tackling that. So I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Yeah, that answers it very well. And there's a couple of bits I'd like to follow up on. Firstly, I will not miss an opportunity to remind listeners of the fact that in all of the years in this country where we've had racist street movements or political movements, none of them until now have ever chanted the name of the Prime Minister, including deeply right-wing and psychopathic Prime Ministers like Margaret Thatcher or even Tony Blair. They do, however, chant the name of Boris Johnson. I think that's something that should bring us up a little bit. If I may, can I just say that nationally, some of the elements that I read it as, and as I say, I know, again, Black Lives Matter is not centralised, we understand that, but nationally, you know, are we calling for justice, proper justice for people who have been killed in police custody, for Beli Mujinga and people like that, and just a better level of local understanding for the police? I mean, what do we want the police to do? So there's two questions there, really. Are we calling for this justice, and what do we want the police to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think we are calling for that justice, and that means, you know, proper justice. It means investigating what actually happened, holding those who were the perpetrators to account, you know, within the confines of the criminal justice system, but still. And, you know, ensuring that future, you know, the communities are safe from this happening again. You know, It can't just be a fact that we recognize the police made a mistake and you know, they're held to account for that, but that it doesn't happen again. And I think, in my opinion, I think that racism, you know, like I said, is very deeply rooted in the system itself. and it can't simply be eradicated from, you know, holding ex police officer to account, or even having a review of how the police behave, or some kind of training for the police or whatever. Because I think the police as an institution, its role in society is to protect the interests of the state, and the state is racist, and therefore it replicates that racism. So there isn't a kind of easy fix to this. But I think that by, and this kind of goes to the second question as well, but I think by taking on issues as they come in an immediate way, so, you know, justice for Beli Majinga, justice for Mark Duggan killed by the police, and Edson Da Costa killed by the police, and you know, all the others, we move in the direction of understanding that is a deeper issue than these things, and being able to tackle it at a higher level. Because I don't think we can go straight from zero to abolish the police to bring down capitalism. You know, it's a kind of process, and I think we need to work our way up there. You know, build the widest movement we can, which can take on these issues one by one, and, you know, build on them wider. I said recently that I think the unofficial motto of our movement should be, it's not enough. So we fight for everything, but every time we do, and every time we hopefully win, we say it's not enough, and we carry on.
Yeah, I quite agree, and it's something that's very frustrating, I find, both within the self and also to try to communicate to other people about the deep need for a long commitment. A couple of good examples that I often refer back to are the Hillsborough Justice Campaign, which again, for listeners who aren't as familiar with it, took 27 years to achieve the justice it needs. Totally unjustified that it took that long, but nevertheless, it took that long. The Orgreave Truth and Justice Campaign still fighting, and I think that's clocking up to 30 years now. Do you feel this, maybe personally, but also a need to, as I often do, to communicate to social justice movements, are we prepared for this for the long haul?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think...
Can I put it another way? Are you prepared to make this a major factor in your life?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the kind of conversations we need to be having with people. And I think that the more people who understand that and who are willing to do that, the better chance we have of building our movement in the way that we need to. But I mean, I will also say that, you know, there are moments where things rapidly develop, like we're seeing right now with the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, people have been campaigning on issues of police brutality and racial justice and justice for this person and justice for that person for a long time. And then, you know, a moment like this comes along and it rapidly speeds up the process, you know, where you go from not only asking for justice for Breonna Taylor, but abolish the police, you know. So, it doesn't necessarily have to, we don't have to necessarily think that it will take forever and that we can only work in small steps. But by starting to work in those small steps and by building that infrastructure of our movement that is constantly on these things, we can relate to those moments when they come. We can, you know, instigate those moments if, you know, in some cases, and help to develop the movement, you know, as it comes.
Just as a kind of factor to that, and I mean, I know what I feel about this. My attitude towards the police and the armed forces is not, should we say, the popular one among my community, certainly. I mean, is the movement seeing the an abolishing or the defunding of the police? And if we were in favour of that, among other things, I'll give you a bit more detail of this second part of the question in a minute, but how do we communicate that to people who perhaps just don't entirely get it? They're not bad actors, they're not people who are trying to hide their racism, but maybe they don't look at that situation and feel confident. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been having conversations with friends of mine, you know, who are, you know, they're not racist. They're, you know, they also support Black Lives Matter, but if you talk about defunding or abolishing the police, you know, question marks get raised. I think that's natural. We're kind of trained to believe that the police are there to protect us. And moving that conversation to identifying what the police's actual role is, that, you know, there is a case for that we would be safer without a police, with an alternative system, is a difficult one, but I think it's one we can start to have. I don't think we're in the same place here in the UK as they are in the US, that we would be able to kind of make a demand to defund or abolish the police in the same way. But I think this is the time to start having those conversations and to start building the arguments about what police actually are and what they actually do. I mean, if you're a black or brown person in this country, you don't feel safe when you see a police officer on the street, you know, for most of us. Trying to relate that to other people, make them understand that, I think is part of the process. And like I said, I think, you know, the movement taking on issues one step at a time is part of building up to that as well. So, you know, when we talk about let's change the education curriculum so it, you know, deals with some of this stuff, let's start looking at why the police were even set up to begin with. What was their role in the colonies? You know, what was their role in the Peterloo massacre, etc.? You can start building up to these other debates, which, you know, at some point could have more traction and could be a more feasible demand.
Yeah, somebody was holding a sign outside a statue the other day, you probably saw it saying, "British history matters." I was like, "Oh, madam, I agree with you." You have no idea how much I agree with you. Yeah, and you just mentioned a couple of really choice cuts right there. Just to kind of elaborate on that, maybe there's nothing else to add to this, but I'll just elaborate on why I asked the question. I'm just thinking that on occasion, some people, maybe even perhaps from my family, who aren't around anymore, who would not have understood where the Black Lives Matter movement is coming from. But equally, they might have looked at, say, a threat to remove the police, and they might have thought, but, you know, I could get burgled more or I'd be less confident going out the street. I mean, I do have some sympathy for some people who feel that way because, like, it's all they've ever known. And perhaps, as you say, on the first steps to having these discussions, maybe this is... I was interested to reach out to people. And one of the reasons I'd be interested is I'm really not very good at it. I'm deeply impatient, and I actually get quite agitated with people who don't know as much as I do, purely on the basis of, I think, if I know this and I'm a fucking postman, you should know these things. Do you know what I'm saying? I would like to kind of be able to explain to people. And I think that what I'm seeing a little bit now is people perhaps understanding, white people perhaps understanding that walking down the street when you are a darker skin tone does put you into an entirely different world. You know, because we are seeing a situation of a return to 60s and 70s shite where people can be abused walking down the street, you know. And I hope they do understand, because that's what this is about. It's about the fact that, as I see it anyway, and I'm pulling this one out a little long here, so I'll put it to bed now. But maybe they feel they can understand that. See, as you just said, seeing a policeman doesn't fill you with hope or confidence. Actually, quite the reverse.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, in terms of the way our movement should orient itself, I think it is very important that we all, you know, all of us who think like this should be trying to have these conversations with people we know. And, you know, I absolutely agree with you. It is hard to have patience to do that. It's not an easy task. But I think the role of the movement should be to aim higher than that. And I say this because, for example, in the United States right now, in the last 4 weeks that the Black Lives Matter movement has erupted, it has gained more in terms of public opinion, in terms of support, than it has in the last 6 years. The way the movement broke out has massively shifted people's opinions in and of itself immediately. I saw a recent poll that over 50% of Americans, white and black, in all parts of the country, agreed with the fact that the Minneapolis police station was burnt down. They thought that was a good thing, which is quite incredible when you think about it. And so this is the kind of impact that I think our movement can have. And it's when we aim to the top and when we talk about, you know, the kind of bigger picture and express ourselves on the streets and in our communities in that way, I think it can have a profound impact in building people's consciousness, even more sometimes than I think individual conversations, because it kind of bolsters that. And I think one example in this country is the anti-war movement. You look at public opinion before and after 2002, and you see that the role of the big movement that spilled out in the streets all over this country and in every community, the role that had in changing people's opinion about whether the war was a good idea or not. And then going forward, you know, when it came to bombing Libya in 2011, the majority of the public were opposed to that because of the experience of the anti-war movement of in 2003. So I feel like that's the kind of way the movement should be heading, to have those big conversations on a national level, which can then be fed into by individual conversations.
Yeah. And also worth remembering that at least where the first round of voting went, we managed to beat them back on involvement in Syria too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's well worth remembering. So you mentioned Stop the War, because I know you're involved in that too. A movement that was perhaps better known at the beginning of the last decade than perhaps it is now, but still relevant. What's the intersectionality of the two movements here, do you think, if any?
Yeah, I think there's a big intersection. I mean, I think there's some very direct examples. For example, both in the United States and here, we've had police forces that have been trained by Israeli soldiers. So there's a very direct example of how the occupation of Palestine and the apartheid system, which is being inflicted on Palestinians, which is being supported by our government, is also feeding into the racism we're seeing within and the authoritarian measures being used here on our streets. We can also see that our politicians over here who have certain opinions on Black Lives Matter protesters being extremists and thugs and all the rest of it are the same ones who support the bombing of Yemen and sell the weapons that are being used to kill Yemeni children, etc. So there's those very direct examples. There is also, I think, the case in terms of how much money is being spent on our military and on these operations in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, which is not being used in our communities here, which is not being used to fund PPE for the NHS, or any of these things, or cladding which is inflammable, etc. So there's that as well. But I think it also goes deeper in just the same system which profits of racism here in Britain profits of the death of black and brown people in the rest of the world. And I think we can draw that connection. So I think there's a big intersection of our movements, and I think we need to make these connections.
Being a member of the ethnic minority myself, I totally agree. And growing up in this part of the world, where there was a huge percentage of us getting stopped by just literally walking up the road, but we just got used to it, and there was a certain amount of apathy as well from us, and we just used to it. I just want to educate the listeners, or probably so Black Lives Matter, where it started in regards to the US, just to bring an analogy to the US. And how ethnic minorities are treated there. So the Black Lives protests are quite different to the civil rights protests in the 70s and 60s and 70s, in that it's all colours actually attending the peaceful protests. I mean, it's all colours really, especially in the US, which makes it totally different to the civil rights protests, Rodney King, and more recently the terrible deaths of black lives recently. And just to put it into perspective, so the 60s we had the voting rights bill, which allowed the BAME community to be able to vote. That was only in the 60s in the US. End of World War II, where we had the veterans bill. So if you fought in World War II, you were given a house, basically, and that wealth was passed down to your families later on. However, if you were black and fought in World War II, you weren't applicable for that. And we're those veterans centred in America. Those areas eventually became what they are now, pretty very poor areas, because that wealth wasn't being, there was no house to pass down to your kids and your kids' kids. So you could see a lot of the anger there, and when people are getting educated in this. And when we talk about the police here, Shabir, as the Stephen Lawrence case did throw up, and what we all knew as ethnic minorities, and certainly me being over 50, what we always knew was, but there was then, and we're only talking 1993, institutionalised racism within the police force. And that was a real eye-opener, not just at the time, because we all knew it, but the later reports and findings. And it was like literally the 59th minute where they were about to throw away all the evidence. It was locked away in some police station they were going to knock down. And just a innocent sergeant there said, well, you know, there's this Stephen Lawrence stuff. What do I do with it? And then, you know, it just started to unravel then. But with that case in particular here in the UK threw out a lot of questions, unanswered questions. I don't think there's nearly enough. Just on that, yesterday, a group called Ubical Initiative, a BAME group here, they're taking legal proceedings against the government. So they wrote one of two letters to the government about the COVID inquiry and how it affects the BAME community. And the basis for their legal findings is this, and this is quite scary actually. So those Filipino nurses who work in the NHS, so as a whole, the Filipino community as a whole, in all what they do, not just nurses, they account for 1.4% of NHS staff, Filipinos. However, 30%, just the nurses, 30% of fatalities due to the COVID virus were Filipina, which is quite scary actually. As I said, as a whole, Filipino community account for 1.4% of the NHS, but that 30% of deaths was all Filipino in just nurses, and as a whole it was 25%. So they've gone in on this long awaited BAME report, as you mentioned, about how it attacks the BAME community, and it was meant to be a long-awaited BAME report. I know they get asked about it in these press conferences, but that is a scary statistic. And when we talk about immigrants, and that will, that's a real sacrifice. These people have got kids and families, and
also, I think that's a very good example, Dave. I think of the kind of thing where you say it about the population.
Yeah, that is quite a scary statistic, actually.
Yeah,
you know,
I quite agree. Yeah.
If they account, if the Filipino community in the NHS just staff accounts for just 1.4%, but yet 30% of Filipinos in the just the nurses section have died. Mm. Oh, you know, and that's the legal grounding they're going on. So, fingers crossed that something happens with that. That was issued on Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, good luck to them. I mean, I think it really speaks to the government's actions that they've tried to cover this up the way that they have in the report that they released, and the, you know, the key findings they left out. And, you know, it points to their complete kind of deliberate callousness, you know, in not going into lockdown when they could, in not sourcing the PPE that they needed, even when they'd run that drill a few years ago when Jeremy Hunt was the health secretary and were told that they needed the PPE and stuff, and they left it. And I think it also points to something very important, which is the privatization of the NHS. I mean, very early on when the pandemic hit, it was the cleaners and the outsourced staff of private companies that have contracts with the NHS who are cutting the pay, in some cases not paying their disproportionately BAME staff, you know, who are refusing to give them PPE even when they ask for it. And one example that sticks in my head is the cleaners at Lewisham Hospital, who literally not been paid for 2 months. They asked for PPE because they had started taking in COVID patients and they had no protective equipment whatsoever. And the company wrote to them saying, you don't need it. So, you know, the unaccountability of private companies, which are being given up these, you know, lucrative contracts in our NHS, and the same companies which have still been, you know, during the course of the pandemic, have still been given more contracts. You have companies like Serco and, you know, who have horrific records of the things that they've, previous contracts they've run and the impacts that they've had. And yeah, it's just it's such a rotten system all the way to its core.
Well, I've always said, so we've had many debates here on All the Rage, just about the privatisation. We only just found out last week when we interviewed Jamie Woodcock that a lot of the courier companies who were sending out these, and they're part of the NHS, the courier companies, sending out the test kits, a separate company's been hired from the outside to do it. So that's a section of privatisation, even while this is happening. But it's something that we've talked about, and I totally agree in regards to Harrow. Northwick Park Hospital was straight away accounted as a main threat in regards to COVID. And that's in the centre of Harrow. It seemed to hit areas, as I said, where people have to work. So there was a report recently. So I grew up in Harlesden. So in Harlesden, in 1 week, in one particular week, there was 84 fatalities because the majority of the people, they have to work. They huddle up on all together on the bus stops, the cleaners and so forth. At the same time, 3 miles down the road in Richmond, there was no fatalities because the majority of Richmond didn't have to work. And 80, you know, in that particular week, and this is not me throwing pine, this is a BBC documentary that was on 6 o'clock news. So it was made available. It was there. It was a full report. It tells you something that, and obviously Harlesden is one of the, is a deprived area in a nutshell. So that was a scary statistic. And I wouldn't mind if they put it on at 10 or 11 traditionally, but they bang this out at 6 p.m. But again, we're still waiting for that long-awaited report on COVID and the BAME community. I don't know when that is, so I don't know how these legal proceedings are going to go, but there was plenty of opportunity to do the report, and there was two letters. The first letter that this group, BAME community, had was signed by all the leading BAME community in influential positions, Sadiq Khan, Mrs. Lawrence, as I said. It's interesting that we have elements of the BAME community on the government's front bench. And I'll say this at every show on John's show, their silence is deafening.
Yeah, well, speaking of long-haul social justice movements, just keep getting longer, don't they? I'm glad you brought it up, because these are very, very good examples of a need to commit. I mean, one of the things, and I can understand how it feels overwhelming sometimes, to feel like, you know, all around you is like whack-a-mole. Some people use it, that example, you know, there's one issue, there's another issue, there's another issue, there's another issue. Well, firstly, that's what happens when you don't address things for 30 years or more. And secondly, yeah, there'll be even more tomorrow if you don't start fighting these ones. I also want to bring up the point that there are no social movements that I can think of in history that didn't break bad laws at some point or another. So yeah, the law is the law, and we all adhere to it as best we can, but sometimes laws are inappropriate, unjust themselves, and need to be damaged and brought down and changed. Also, you know, again, we talked about the statue thing on the show the other week, me and Dave, and roughly speaking, our point was more people knew who Edward Colson was and what he did on the Sunday night his statue was pulled down than they had the previous Saturday evening. So in that sense, you're right, statues do teach us about our history. Yeah, by knocking the shit out of them, we learn a lot about them. So that's a good move. In fact, this is probably a good point to ask you. So another organisation you associate with, the People's Assembly, who also don't have as big a, and is not, you know, for better or worse, than as big a profile as they may have done in previous years. Mm. Well, roughly, you know, what do you do there? And again, where do you think this intersects with Black Lives Matter, if at all?
Yeah, so the People's Assembly has been campaigning against austerity since, I think, about 2015, probably earlier. We've run some really big campaigns in the last few years. What we're doing at the moment is essentially taking on the government arguments that they're making around COVID and the potential for a new round of austerity to pay for the public spending they've done during this pandemic, and kind of, you know, building people's arguments and people's awareness of what's going on, you know, before that happens. So they've been doing kind of weekly Thursday night events with Laura Pidcock, who's quite involved in the People's Assembly now, you know, building kind of groups all around the country and trying to take on local issues as well as the big national picture. I think it's an absolutely essential campaign. I mean, this government, you know, they ended austerity in just name, in reality. They were still carrying on with cuts. They were still carrying on with underfunding the NHS, and is likely to get even worse if and when we come out of this crisis, because they've spent so much money. It's a very necessary campaign. I think where it intersects with Black Lives Matter is what I said before, is that Black and brown people have been disproportionately hit by austerity, because the things that were cut were youth services and mental health services and healthcare services and all these things which the most deprived areas, the places where Black and brown people are living have been hit the hardest. I think it's absolutely intertwined. And I think when you think of just that one report which said that at least 130,000 people were killed because of austerity, it shows you the magnitude of the government's actions and why it's so necessary to keep fighting on it.
With all of that in mind, sort of refocusing momentarily on Black Lives Matter, organising. This is something we talk about in the show a lot. This is something I hear all social movements, all trade unions that I know talk about. I'm very, very big. I like to tell people and lecture people that you need to organise. But at the same time, I'm not always sure the best ways of doing it and how. What are your experiences of organising across the three organisations you're a part of and anywhere else that you've done it for that matter? What kind of advice can you give people of your experiences of organising? I'm sorry, that sounds a little bit like a job interview question. That wasn't the intention.
I think that's a very good question, because I think there are a lot of people who are learning about what's going on, who are angered or empowered and inspired by what's going on and want to do something. So getting people organized is, I think, the most important thing to do. I think there are a number of things. So at the moment, obviously, we have Black Lives Matter protests. So I think anyone who can, who's low risk or isn't living with someone vulnerable and who feels able to, should try and go down to a protest and show their support. I think where we've had local protests, which, there have been so many of, I think over 200 towns and cities in the UK have had local Black Lives Matter protests. And most of those, because they're in smaller numbers and in smaller areas, they are properly socially distanced. So I think where there's one, people should go down to one. Where there isn't, they should try and organize one. And in terms of organizing one, I think it's a matter of calling it, putting it out on social media, speaking to people in the networks you have, whether that's kind of local Labour Party groups or trade union groups or even the kind of coronavirus mutual aid groups, student groups, you know, all these kinds of things to get the word out. And I think it's, you know, that's doable. I also think that particularly at the moment, trade union activism is one of the most important things that people can be doing. So I would encourage anyone, if you're not in a trade union, join a trade union. And not just join the trade union, but when you're in the trade union, be an active member of that trade union. You know, be at the meetings, become a rep, you know, pass motions, etc. Because I think that kind of rank and file activity is the driving force of the labor movement and can really bring these movements together. I mean, like, when I saw, you know, Justice for George Floyd and Black Lives Matter stuck on, you know, trains on the London Underground, and I saw firefighters kneeling and nurses coming out of the hospital to observe minutes silence and stuff like that. That shows a real intersection of kind of working class activity and understanding how, you know, racism is rooted in the same exploitation and the same oppression that, you know, other sections of the working class are facing. So I think that's very important. And I think that's one very practical thing that people can do to organize at this moment. I think also at the moment, we're living in an age where social media activism can work and can be very useful to getting arguments out there, to encouraging others to do things practically and understanding what's going on. So, you know, there's tons of Zoom public meetings going on. There's tons of organizing meetings happening on Zoom and rallies and the kind. You know, get involved wherever you can. You know, email your MPs and sign petitions and share petitions and all that kind of stuff. And I feel like every little bit, you know, helps. And the key is to not feel like there's no benefit to being involved and to do whatever you can, wherever you can. And it all kind of adds up.
You just have to get involved in things and you never know what you pick up. You know, yeah. One of the things I do, I've told this story on the show before. You know, I often go to demonstrations, particularly in London, which is where I'm most central to. And you never know what you get out of that. You never know who you meet. You know, the people I've met through this show and we have, some of us have plans to go on and do other things. What I always find funny is that when I go to a demonstration in London with all of the thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of people who show up, sometimes even more than that, I always see a couple of people I know.
Yeah.
You just kind of gravitate somehow towards each other in the melee of people and you know, and in normal times when people are a little bit more, you know, put together and go, oh, hello, mate, how are you? You know, it's a great experience, especially in a city, which, you know, cities can be one, they can be alienating, but they can also be wonderful, I think. Last couple of questions, and one of these is a little bit unfair to ask any one person, but you're here, so I'm going to ask. We were talking about this a little bit before the show, is about the amazing turnout that Black Lives Matter has shown all over the world and specifically here in the UK. How can we keep it going?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, I think, so in the US, I think the movement is still going very strong and on the streets. I mean, in this last week, we've still seen massive protests of tens and hundreds of thousands of people on the streets all over the US. But I think what I would say, And I think that's slightly different here because the nature of the movement here is kind of in a first instance more of a solidarity movement than a direct issue in the way that it is over there. But I think with any movement, maintaining high numbers of people on the streets for a long period of time is very difficult and usually not possible. I mean, I think one kind of exception to that, I won't go too deep into history, but just in recent times is probably the Gilets Jaunes in France, who managed to sustain that kind of level of street mobilization for quite a while. But I think we can expect that there won't be the same numbers of people out protesting, you know, in the coming weeks and months. And so what we need to be looking at is more concrete ways of carrying on what the movement is trying to do. And I think one thing is, you know, what I just said is trade union activity. I mean, the other day on Friday was Juneteenth, which is commemorated in the US as the day that slavery was abolished. and there was a big show of trade unions organizing with Black Lives Matter. So you had kind of Amazon wildcat strikes with precarious black and brown workers walking out. You had dock workers across the West Coast shutting down the ports and, you know, having a massive march, which, you know, people like Angela Davis and Boots Riley went to speak at. So I think bringing that, the labor movement element of it, you know, which is in and of itself already a kind of existing means of organizing. So bringing the Black Lives Matter movement into that and into that activity, I think is very important. I think developing kind of concrete demands which people can carry on with even when they're not out on the streets protesting is quite important. So, for example, in Oxford, they protested against, you know, in solidarity with George Floyd and, you know, for Black Lives Matter, but they also kind of demanded that the statue of Cecil Rhodes is brought down, which it looks like they're being successful in now because Oxford University is reviewing if they can, they want to remove it. So, you know, that's one tangible thing that the movement has achieved there. And even when people are not protesting, they should now carry that on. So once the statue is down, now talk about why is Oxford University disproportionately not letting black and brown people into the university? Why is the curriculum teaching X, Y, and Z and whatever? And that doesn't necessarily have to mean protests on the ground. It can be campaigned on in different ways. So I think that's the kind of thing we should try and replicate everywhere we can and, you know, move our campaigning into those tangible things. And I think obviously it very much depends on what happens with the lockdown and with coronavirus. I mean, I'm quite pessimistic in terms of this lockdown actually ending. I think that the measures that have been eased so far have been done in a very ridiculous and callous and dangerous way. And I think we're heading for a second wave. And if that happens, we'll probably be in a even worse lockdown. But I mean, I think when we move into a situation where it's safe to be out on the streets again, we should be ready to take to the streets and to, you know, take our fight directly to the government, to, you know, fully hold them to account and to not stop short of calling for Boris Johnson to be removed, quite simply. So, yeah, I think that's the kind of way that the movement can carry on.
The only thing I'll just say in closing, and speak on this in any way that you want to, but I'm hoping about we can get more of this element of Black Lives Matter centrally into the blood, as it were, of the anti-fascist movement as a whole. I've noticed over the years that a lot of kind of anti-racist demonstrations I've been to, that they have been powerful and fantastic, and many, many different people there, but it's often been predominantly white. What I like now about this movement is people who look like me are in the minority, and so we should be, because this is a movement that we're in solidarity in, but we are absolutely in no way, nor should we attempt to lead it in any way. So yeah, I'm hoping that goes into the, as I say, the mainstream of anti-fascist work, if there is such a thing. Maybe we don't have a mainstream, actually, saying that.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely. I mean, I think the far right and the fascists absolutely need to be defeated. And what we saw in London last week with the fascists, you know, in central London, attacking Black Lives Matter protesters. What we saw earlier this week in Glasgow, fascists attacking protesters in St. George's Square demanding an end to...
It was a refugee thing, wasn't it?
Refugees, yeah, exactly.
An end to second-class status, basically, let's call it what it is.
Yeah. I think that's really dangerous, and I think we need a united movement that you know, will take them on. And I think that, you know, I look back to the kind of anti-Nazi league that was successful in pushing back the National Front in the 80s, and, you know, that's what we kind of need to emulate. We need black and white people united, you know, and directly confronting the fascists, but also, you know, the movement which looks into the deeper issues that, you know, breeds the conditions that allows fascists to grow and you know, takes those on as well.
All I would say is, Shabir, thank you very much for being on All the Rage. Total and complete unadulterated solidarity with everything you're doing here, and Black Lives Matter, everybody.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.tracksfm.org.